to Breitbart News Daily. Thanks for being here. Slater Radio on the Twitter and the Instagram. Slater at Breitbart.com is my email. By the way, we do stream, simulcast the show on the First TV, DirecTV channel 347. If you go to Slater Radio on Twitter, we retweet out the link. You can watch it right on Twitter now as well. But we're on Roku and Pluto and Samsung TVs and Vizio and whatever. Everywhere you can stream, you can watch the First TV. And we simulcast the second two hours of the show. We had a ton today, but... So the first segment we talked about the bloodbath comment, the latest on that. We kind of talked about that yesterday in this podcast, so we're not going to put that there. We did a ton in the second hour about Ohio and the Senate race tonight. But I mean, we'll find out tonight what happens in that Senate race. So, and maybe that'll be tomorrow's podcast. Don't know. So we'll table that. And again, if you subscribe to SiriusXM, you can listen to all this. Let's put here the second segment we did in the first hour, where we talked about the absolute intentional and proud deceit from Deborah Birx. Now, 4 years later, after COVID lockdowns, here she is bragging about how she betrayed her treachery. And how we should never forget the lessons from COVID. And one of the foremost lessons is these people are liars and they're proud about it. All right, back to these elites being the worst. So COVID was 4 years ago. Crazy, right? I don't know if COVID feels like forever ago or yesterday. I don't know. Which is weird. Like, I can't even make sense of that. I don't even know which it was. Was it yesterday or forever ago? I really don't know. This is Deborah Birx. Do you remember her? She's the woman with the scarf she always wore. They call them scarves? Is that what women call them? What are you, like, fabric around your neck? Is that a scarf? Anyway, she was the White House coronavirus response coordinator. She was not Fauci, she was the main person behind the lockdowns and pushing the lockdowns. Now, her hypocrisy, of course, it was Thanksgiving 2020 where she told people to not leave your house, celebrate Thanksgiving only with your immediate family. Meanwhile, she went to Delaware to mingle with four generations of her family for Thanksgiving. Just one of the many examples of the elite's hypocrisy during COVID. Never forget it. Never forget. And she was called out for it. And she said, well, I was staying at home. It's just that she has several homes. This happened to be one of her homes in Delaware. Something you wouldn't understand, having multiple homes. So that's why you criticized her unfairly, because you just don't understand what life is like when you have multiple homes. I can't understand having multiple homes, because does that mean you have to have twice as much forks and plates? You have to buy a whole nother plate, like set of plates? No. I don't think so. You got to buy like extra chairs and couches. You can't just like bring it all with you. I couldn't do it. Anyway. This is good. She said, this is her other excuse. My daughter hasn't left that house in 10 months. My parents have been isolated for 10 months. They become deeply depressed, as I'm sure many elderly has, as they've not been able to see their sons and their granddaughters. My parents have not been able to see their surviving son for over a year. These are all very difficult things. Yes, I know, Deborah. I know, Deborah. Maybe we shouldn't have a lockdown, Deborah, because of these very difficult things, Deborah. But she didn't care. She broke her very own rules. So she was the 2 weeks to flatten the curve person. So this is from her own book. Now I'm sharing this not only to rehash all the COVID stuff, because I never want to mention the word COVID ever again in my life, but I also don't ever want to forget the lessons of COVID, because then we'll do it again. It'll be 10X. So I'm really torn with ever mentioning, I don't know what to do. I've decided it's important to mention. It's worth bringing up again, especially here on the 4-year anniversary. So this is from her book. In her own words, she said, we had to make these lockdowns palatable to the administration by avoiding the obvious appearance of a full Italian lockdown. So remember, it was Chinese communist propaganda that led to Italy locking down. And there's a direct, there were like direct flights from Wuhan to this one town in Italy because Chinese companies bought all the garment factories in Italy. And they're just shipping Chinese people from Wuhan directly to this town in Italy for years. And this town was like, it's like a Chinese town now in Italy. And that's why there was a ton of COVID there. And they, so Italy locked down first. And that's when, then England locked down. And because England locked down, we locked down. And it was because of Deborah. At this point, I wasn't about to, but she didn't want to make it look like we were doing the same thing. At this point, I wasn't about to use the words lockdown or shutdown. If I had uttered either of those in early March, after being at the White House only 1 week, Oh, are you telling me she was hired right before, she happened to have been hired right before COVID? The political, non-medical members of the task force would have dismissed me as too alarmist, too doom and gloom, too reliant on feelings and not facts. They would have campaigned to lock me down and shut me up. So she wanted to go full CCP, but she wouldn't. She knew she couldn't say it out loud. So what'd she do? 15 days to slow the spread. This is her book. 15 days to slow the spread was a start, but I knew it would be just that. We were not told it would be just that. I didn't have the numbers in front of me yet to make the case for extending it longer, but I had 2 weeks to get them. However hard it had been to get the 15-day shutdown approved, getting another one would be more difficult by many orders of magnitude. She didn't even have evidence for any lockdown beyond 15 days yet, but she would find it. And why lockdowns? Her only other previous experience with infectious disease was AIDS, which is not a respiratory virus. And she wrote her book. She said, with HIV/AIDS, this to how to stop the spread, this meant convincing asymptomatic people to get tested, to seek treatment if they were HIV positive, and to take preventative measures, including wearing condoms. So now here we are in COVID. I knew that government agencies would need to do the same thing to have a similar effect on the spread of COVID. The most obvious parallels with the HIV/AIDS example was the message of wearing masks. Masks equal condoms. Condoms for your face. Face condoms. I regret I did not use that term earlier on. Face condoms. That's not me. That's Deborah Birx, the head of the whole thing. She saw masks as condoms for AIDS. Face condoms. Do you see how? My whole point of this is how these people lie constantly, deceive purposefully. Let me quote Jeffrey Tucker. Jeffrey Tucker, very hard on Trump about this. When I talked to him a couple years ago, he said that Trump's COVID response is disqualifying. I don't know if he's changed his tune now. This was before Trump even announced he was running again. So I don't know if he's changed his tune, but he's very tough on Trump for platforming these people. This is what he wrote. Recall that for the remainder of the year, 2020, the White House was urging normalcy while many states kept locking down. It was an incredible confusion. The CDC was all over the map. I gained the distinct impression of two separate regimes in charge, Trump's regime versus the administrative state that he could not control. Trump would say one thing on the campaign trail, but the regulations and disease panic kept pouring out of his own agencies. This is a version of the deep state. We talked the other day briefly about this push in the media that Trump should not receive the daily intelligence briefings. Oh, no, we talked about this with Nolte, that Trump should not receive the daily intelligence briefings as all other nominees for president always get. And the reason for that is so that you hit the ground running on day one. Right? So you're all caught up for the next 7 months. Boom, you're ready to go when you're president to be president. And there's all these signals out there saying that we shouldn't do that for Trump because he's so dangerous, you can't even give him the information anymore. So the deep state working against President Trump. And this happened when he was president too. Of course, with the deep state, and here it is with his own agencies during CDC, during COVID as well. So this is Deborah Birx's book. So she would write these weekly reports after the heavily edited documents were returned to me. So she would write them. She'd give them to the people above her at the White House with edits back to her. After I received the edited documents, I would reinsert what they had objected to, but place it in different locations. I'd also reorder and restructure the bullet points. So the most salient, the points the administration objected the most, no longer fell at the start of the bullet point. I shared these strategies with the three members of the data team also writing these reports. Our Saturday and Sunday report writing routine soon became write, submit, revise, hide, resubmit. Fortunately, this strategic sleight of hand worked. That they never seemed to catch this subterfuge. Subterfuge. Her words, subterfuge, left me to conclude that either they read the finished reports too quickly or they neglected to do the word search that would have revealed the language to which they objected. In slipping these changes past the gatekeepers and continuing to inform the governors of the need for the three big mitigations, masks, testing, sentinel testing, which is testing all the time, everyone nonstop, and limits on indoor social gatherings, I felt confident I was giving the states permission to escalate public health mitigation with the fall and winter coming. Can this person go to jail? Can we put this person in jail? Subterfuge? Admitting to lying and deceiving and going behind the administration's back as she spoke to the states on what to do, causing incredible damage to our nation when it wasn't necessary at all. Check this out. The guidance gambit, the whole thing she just, the whole charade she just spoke on, was only the tip of the iceberg of my transgressions in my effort to subvert Scott Atlas's dangerous position. So Scott Atlas was a guy who came in afterwards and was like, "You're crazy, Deborah Birx. I don't know why they kept Deborah Birx." But her transgression, just the beginning. Ever since Vice President Pence told me to do what I needed to do, I'd engage in very blunt conversations with the governors. I spoke the truth that some White House senior advisors weren't willing to acknowledge, censoring my reports and putting up guidance that negated the known solutions was only going to perpetrate COVID-19's vicious circle. What I couldn't sneak past the gatekeepers in my reports, I said in person. So she would call up the governors. So she'd sneak as much as she could through the reports. And then when she couldn't fit through the reports, she would just call and say in person. This is Jeff Tucker. To conclude, the story of the lockdowns is a tale of biblical proportions, at once evil and desperately sad and tragic. A story of power, scientific failure, intellectual insanity, outrageous arrogance, feudalistic impulses, mass delusion, plus, and this is an important part of the story that I haven't added to the story yet, it's why I'm bringing it up here and why I think it's a good connection to the bloodbath story, plus political treachery and conspiracy. That's an element to the story. Subterfuge, in her own words. It was one thing. It's bad enough to have the feudalistic impulses, right? Every governor thought they were a little, or at least the Democrat ones thought they were little dictators. The absolute insanity, the fear. One thing to have the mass delusions. One thing to have all that. But on top of that, the betrayal, the treachery, the intentional deceit within the government against the president, against what was good and true. Says it's a real horror, a real life horror for our ages. A tale of how the land of the free became a despotic hellscape so quickly and unexpectedly. Birx was at the center of it, confirming all of your worst fears right here in a book that anyone can buy. She is so proud of her role that she dares to take all credit. Fully convinced that the Trump-hating media will love and protect her deceit from exposure and condemnation. And it's worth noting as well that Birx's book, it's 525 pages, zero footnotes. There's not a single footnote. If it even pretended to have any actual scientificness to it at all, There would be, they're not a single footnote in 525 pages. Never underestimate these people's ability to not just lie, not just deceive, not just spin, but downright treachery and betrayal. And then be proud about it. And brag about it. Welcome back to Breitbart News Daily. Thanks for being here. We talked to Emma Jo Morris about the state of New York City. She's wonderful as always. I want to play for you here, though, our interview with Francis Martel, the world editor. I think we should know that Niger is a thing right now. No one else is talking about it, but Francis is all over it. I saw a headline with Niger in it, and I thought, I don't know anything about this and can't even pretend to. I was talking to producer Zach just a moment ago, and he thought we were talking about Nigeria, which is a different country. And he told me a fun fact about Nigeria. Zach, would you like to regale the people with your fun fact about Nigeria? I don't want to steal
Nigerians
your fact from you.
Nigerians absolutely love the game of Scrabble and dominate at it.
What?
They're really good at it. I don't know why. They just are.
So sure enough, I Googled it. NPR, Nigeria is the number one Scrabble nation in the world. What? How could... They all the Scrabble champions... come from Nigeria. It's like Indians with spelling bees and Russians with chess. And Nigerians decided we're going to crush it at Scrabble. Alas, Niger is just to the north of Nigeria, and I don't know how good they are at Scrabble, but they're pretty good at kicking our military out of their country. Francis Martel, our world editor. Francis, how are you?
I'm doing great. I just learned something. I did not know Nigeria was the Scrabble capital of the world.
Zach, you just... Do you know what just happened here?
That's insane.
You
taught Francis a thing.
I'm cutting out this audio and saving it forever.
That is unbelievable. Unbelievable. Out of all the year I've been talking to Francis, I've never stumped her and I've never taught her anything, certainly. And here you are. Wow, good for you, Zach. Well done. Hang it up now. Francis, this is Washington Post. Niger junta announces end to military relationship with the United States. Why do I care about Niger?
Because we have 1,000 troops there, give or take, and it's been our base for a long time for anti-terror operations in the region. We have some other friendly relations with neighboring countries like Nigeria, but the parts of Nigeria where there's Boko Haram and jihadis is very unstable. We can't just have troops there, whereas Niger provided a much safer environment as a base for us to do operations there. And against, it's not just Nigeria, it's Cameroon, it's, you know, Mali, all that area, the sort of top half of Africa. There's a lot of, you know, it's fertile ground for Al-Qaeda and ISIS and all these groups. So we had, you know, a significant relationship there. It was very stable. You know, you didn't hear about Niger in the news very often. I think the last time before the coup this summer there that I remember hearing sort of mainstream American news talking about Niger was when some troops died there under Obama conducting some sort of operation. I think it was against Al-Shabaab, but I don't remember specifically which jihadi group. So it was relatively stable. It was one of these international situations that was not a problem. It was just fine. And now under Biden, we have this coup that is anti-Western, and it's one of many coups. We had a coup in Burkina Faso. We had a coup in the neighboring countries, in two more, I think in Mali, and oh my God, I don't remember the third one, but in Guinea, I think. And so you have these coups, these like dominoes falling, where you have these military takeovers, and now Niger is ruled by the National Council for the Safeguard of the Fatherland. That's the official name of the coup. And they have decided they want nothing to do with the United States.
Is there a reason why? Is it something we did? Is it us or them? Who's why do they want nothing to do with us?
Well, the biggest, it's France. It's mostly France. So France colonized a big chunk of Africa, as we all know. Niger was part of that. They're a French-speaking country. And they have, for years, basically lost their tolerance of French colonialism under Macron. And so they see the West generally as an invading force. They don't want the influence of the West. So it's a lot France, but it's also us in that when the coup happened last summer, the Biden administration sent Victoria Nuland over, who was, you know, the big architect of we need to spend all our money in Ukraine before she retired. She went over there and she basically said, we'll be friends with you guys, but you have to respect democracy and human rights, and you have to keep our troops here, and you can't be friends with Russia, you can't be friends with Iran. Basically lectured this coup, which is, you know, I don't know if people remember the images last summer, but these were a bunch of guys with machine guns that just strolled onto the Nigerian equivalent of the Today Show and announced that there was a new government. And, you know, this diplomat came in and told them, you know, gave them a laundry list of things to do, and they basically said, go away. And so last week we had another round of this where we sent diplomats over and we told them, well, you can't have diplomatic relations with this person, and we're concerned. And, you know, for legitimate reasons, we don't want our troops in a country where the Iranian government can collect intelligence on our troops. But certainly the way that the junta responded to this, their position is that our attitude is berating and imperialistic, and they're just going to kick us out because they don't want to be lectured.
Okay. I don't know if Larry Summers said this or he's quoting someone else, but Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary, former President of Harvard, he said, somebody from a developing country said to me, what we get from China is an airport. What we get from the United States is a lecture. Is there truth to that, slash is there a better way that maybe Trump or someone else would handle Niger for our own benefit? As you said, again, we have 1,000 troops there.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's not that that's inaccurate, but there's a giant asterisk on that airport, right? China yes. is a colonialist power. It will give you the airport, and then it will control the airport and claim that because it built the airport, it can enforce Chinese law on your soil. And also you're, you know, tremendously in debt to the Chinese state now, so you have to go to the UN and support the Uyghur genocide, and you have no more foreign policy of your own.
Oh, that's so great. So that's their, they lift that up as, hey, China gives us free stuff and you guys tell us what to do. But meanwhile, it's China who is telling them what to do more so than even we ever have.
Yes. And, you know, when the United States lectures you about democracy and human rights, there's no follow up to that, right? Like Anthony Blinken shows up, says democracy is good, and then he leaves. You don't get the airport, but you also don't get the blackmail and extortion like you do with China. But for a lot of these countries that are tremendously impoverished, for a lot of these countries that have very corrupt leadership that need to sustain a very wealthy lifestyle while the rest of the country starves, China is a much better option. I'm not 100% sure that that's exactly what the Nigerian junta is looking for. I think they're much more interested in relations with Russia, because Russia will send the Wagner group, the Wagner group will kill all the jihadis, and then the exchange is, you know, badmouth the United States at the UN, which is, it's a slightly better deal than the Chinese Belt and Road.
And this is okay if it's not, I want to know the truth. Is this a sign of Biden's weakness? Like, we have plenty of examples of that where that is true. Is this a sign of Biden's weakness, or is this just internal Niger anti-colonial stuff that we happen to have been now wrapped up in?
Well, the internal Niger colonialism stuff has been going on for decades. So the variable that changed is our president. I do think it's a Biden failure. I think the way it's a Biden failure and a Blinken failure, the way the State Department has addressed other countries is extremely arrogant. We see that with Israel, right? The way that they're trying to micromanage the war on Hamas, that's how they treat every single country. And you can, like, no one's going to like you if you just show up to a country, tell them everything they do wrong, try to change, you know, the way they do everything, and then just leave with no support. And that's not to say that some of these countries don't need to be told they're doing wrong things. Obviously, we need to stand up for human rights abuses or against human rights abuses. Obviously, we need to have a moral compass. But diplomacy is all about tone. Diplomacy is all about getting people to do what you want while they feel happy doing it. And the second half of that, the Biden administration is just a complete failure at.
Interesting. We only got about 3 minutes. Latest with Haiti. You wrote the article that the prime minister, who has not been able to come back because the barbecue took over the airport, says he's announcing his plan to resign. What is next for Haiti? And I also read that the Biden administration is quietly not allowing these Haitians to come into America and they're sending them back. What have you been hearing?
Well, right now what we are hearing is that on the ground in Haiti, barbecue's gangs are having street battles with what's left of the national police. There have been attacks on power plants. So now the tactic by the gangs is to shut down power, shut down electricity, to try to weaken the government. There is this plan. So again, Blinken's plan here is to create a transitional presidential council that will choose a new prime minister and move forward. And it's in complete fantasy land. I think they have 6 or 7 people that they want on the council, but the general population rejects it because they see it as America telling everybody what to do. So you have, you know, it's starting to generate support for people like Guy Philippe, who's this politician who has a very good relationship with Barbecue. Barbecue has said he would like to see him be president. And so you're seeing these sort of anti-American criminal elements getting some popular support because Blinken waltzes in, tells everybody this is what you have to do, and it rubs everyone the wrong way. And it also, you know, you could appoint a transitional presidential council, but you don't have law enforcement. You have no police, basically. Yeah. And you have no, you know, everyone in the elite that used to be part of the government, Barbecue said he's going to kill all of those people. They burned down the home of the national police chief. So there's a very big disconnect between what the U.S.-led coalition wants Haiti to do and what is actually possible on the ground.
Do you anticipate a mass exodus of Haitians into America?
I think they're going to try to go to the Dominican Republic first. Dominican Republic is already building a wall. They want nothing to do with this. And the U.S. is pressuring them to take in more Haitians. That's not going to happen. So I think eventually, yes. And there's going to be a lot of those people that have a legitimate political asylum claim.
That's a good
point.
And
there's going to be a lot
more.
Right.
You're right. I've always said that these illegal immigrants that are coming across claiming asylum, not one of them will be granted asylum or would be granted asylum under the normal asylum laws. But these people might actually now, these Haitians that are fleeing, they might be under.
Yeah,
that's
very hard to argue that Haiti is a place where people can feel safe from, from repression. Especially if someone affiliated with Barbecue becomes the leader of the government, then you have, an official criminal regime. And then that makes it, it's completely legitimate for someone to want to come here to escape that.
Yeah, because you could be murdered for your political opinion, which is one of the reasons that you could be granted asylum. Yeah, all right, that is something. Francis Martel, world editor, no one's better. Francis, great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you, too. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, ma'am. 866-95-PATRIOT, 866-95-PATRIOT. It's amazing that we talked about this last week, that the DR, Dominican, right next door, like they're connected to the same island. It's like, no, we want another. They're building a wall. So then it's like, well, I guess we got nowhere to go but America. It's like, oh, there's a whole host of countries that could all. Nope. Thanks for listening to Breitbart News Daily. On tomorrow's show, we're going to talk about that Supreme Court hearing that took place yesterday about freedom of speech. We'll talk with Professor Bill Jacobson at 7:20. And then Mike Rogers, who's the Trump-endorsed candidate in Michigan, we'll talk with him at 8 o'clock about another state that maybe not as dramatically as Ohio yet should be turning red as well. That's on tomorrow's show. Hope you can join us then. Mike Slater, Breitbart News Daily. Spread the word.